Now let's leap to a lab in Cambridge where two students explain how they're trying to engineer a safer world.
Here we are in the lab. What's this lab called?
The Seawater Lab.
The Seawater Lab. And your name?
Yeshis.
Yeshis. And we've heard about ways in which we could vary, or you could vary, the size of these particles going up. How are you doing that in this lab?
So we are looking at four different atomization methods. Essentially what that means is, how can we spray seawater into very, very small droplets of water? And these then evaporate into salt nanocrystals, which can be used as cloud condensation nuclei, essentially seeds that brighten clouds.
And here in the lab, you're doing it. Imagine, listeners, with all this amazing apparatus spread around, take that for granted. When you're doing the action bit, what happens?
So you can actually see over here is an experimental setup that we have, where on the left-hand side, we generate particles. So Jake right here, my colleague, has one of his sprayers set up. On the back, there's a fish tank. That's one of my sprayers where I make bubbles and I burst them. And then these generated aerosol plumes are extracted through a long tube where we have different devices. We have ones that measure the liquid droplet diameters, as well as we have devices that dry out these droplets to leave just the salt nanocrystals, and then are split to be measured across several different devices. And this gives us a bit more information as to what we're producing and if it is viable for the purpose of marine cloud brightening.
And Jake, when you were doing your A-levels, did you ever imagine you'd be in a laboratory like this doing things like that?
No, absolutely not. It was really only in my second year in undergrad that I learned about this idea of climate repair and concept of marine cloud brightening. And yeah, in my undergrad, I came to uni to do aerospace engineering, and it was actually hearing a lecture by Professor Hugh Hunt on the topic of climate repair that completely swayed my feelings for this and my direction.
It's wild Australian.
Yes, it's wild.
Now, when you look at and you switch on the experiment you're doing, what's it like here in the lab? Is there just this huge spray or huge noise or what?
So it really depends on the atomization method that we're using. Some of them generate huge plumes of spray, and some are very noisy. Some you don't even know they're spraying, they don't generate much or they don't make any noise. But really, there's a lot to keep track of, lots of different instruments, detectors. We're detecting and measuring so many things, regardless of the atomization method that we're using. So yeah, a lot of to keep on top of, really.
And finally, do either of you go out into the field, say in the Arctic or the Antarctic?
Not yet. Currently, we are doing lab-based proof of concepts, but excitingly, you know, recently we were selected to scale up our technologies for an eventual field trial somewhere off the coast of the UK, and that'll be in 3 years' time.
And you looking forward to that, Jake?
Yeah, I just don't know which technology we'll end up using to scale up.
And scaling up is the idea, isn't it? Because these lab experiments are facing, in fact, global solutions.
Yes, and so that's one of the big questions is what we do in the lab reflected if we take it outside?
Congratulations, it's very exciting stuff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So there we are in Cambridge, but what are they all up to, that spraying of ice and polar prospects? The answer is the big one. Some call it geoengineering. And as the progress with reducing emissions becomes more dire, some think drastic action may be needed, and soon, to stop the rot. The front page story of the New Scientist magazine of October 25th reports, and I quote, "The majority of climate scientists expect geoengineering this century." So meet Australian Professor Hugh Hunt of Trinity College in Cambridge with one set of ideas that could help brighten the clouds and thicken the ice.
The melting of especially the Arctic is going quite quickly. What possibly could one do, if the science allows, to ease it off a bit?
The Arctic is melting. It's the sea ice which is melting. And that's the floating ice. And the ice extent, that's sort of the area which is covered by ice floating in the summer, is getting less and less every year. There are two things, of course, that happen. In the summer months, it melts. In the winter months, when the Arctic is in complete darkness, it freezes. So the two things we're looking at, slowing the rate of melting in the summer and increasing the rate of freezing in the winter. So there's perhaps cloud brightening in the summer, which is increasing the reflectivity of clouds, and ice thickening in the winter, which is enabling ice to freeze more rapidly.
They're both geoengineering, which makes some people rather worried.
Well, geoengineering, I think, is a term which has got people wound up for quite a while. If you look at what's going on, for instance, in the Great Barrier Reef with the work that's being done by Southern Cross University to cool the waters around the Great Barrier Reef to prevent coral bleaching, well, they don't call it geoengineering. I mean, it isn't really geoengineering. They look at it as a regional intervention to preserve the coral in the Great Barrier Reef. And I don't think people are calling that geoengineering. If you look at what's going on in the Arctic, the regional interventions, for instance, to thicken the ice around particular communities where they rely on the ice for herding the reindeer that they just can't get from one side of the bay to the other because the ice is too thin. I don't think we're calling that geoengineering, but there are those who would like to call it geoengineering. Is it the thin end of the wedge, the slippery slope? You're right, it is geoengineering and unacceptable and very scary to some. But for me, after 30 years of relatively poor progress in getting off fossil fuels, the unlikeliness of removing CO2 from the atmosphere fast enough, I don't think we've got many options left to us.
What are you doing directly to experiment with this?
On the cloud brightening front, the issues are that spraying seawater to produce a sea spray, salty water spray, those salty water droplets evaporate to form salt crystals, and they get up into clouds to help brighten the clouds, to help nucleate smaller droplets. The power required to produce that spray is too high, which means that realistically, if we wanted to cool the Arctic, the amount of energy required to do it is too high. So we are working on getting the power requirements down by a factor of 10, which would make a huge difference. The next thing we're doing is trying to get the droplet size distribution to be very much more precisely targeted, because it may be on a particular day, say you'd want seawater droplets that are 150 nanometers in a diameter, but then a couple of days later you'd look up in the clouds and say, I think we need a 250 nanometers today. So we're working on how you can dial up the droplet size.
And how would you get those up there in the sky where they needed to act?
Well, that happens naturally. Anybody who does any gliding will tell you about these wonderful updrafts you get, and you know, you look around for them and you find one and it takes you right up. It's fantastic. So what happens is that you get, you know, it's a bit like the rips in the surf, that you get the waves coming in, but you get these areas where the water goes out and you don't want to get caught up in one of those. And that's what you see. You'll spray this spray out of the back of your boat and it produces this mist. And then you'll see this kind of column of your little particles going up and there's a little cloud above. Normally that's invisible, but from time to time you get to see it. Nature does produce salt water droplets when it's stormy and there's waves. And it's that same process, natural process, that gets the particles up to cloud height, which is perhaps a few hundred metres, a kilometre.
And what about the other side of things, keeping the ice there where it should be from the winter?
The ice thickening. The number one thing that we've cottoned on to is that snow on top of ice forms an insulating layer. It really is like having your doona, the tog value. If you could get rid of that snow on top of the ice, then in the cold, dark winter, where the air temperature is minus 50 degrees, then you've got a fighting chance of that coolth getting its way through the ice down to the water underneath, and the water underneath freezes. One way to get rid of the snow is to spray water over it. So what we're doing is putting a hole in the ice and with a pump flooding a few square kilometres of snow-covered ice. and then going away and coming back a year later and measuring the thickness of the ice and comparing the thickness of the ice in a flooded region with the thickness of the ice in an area that wasn't flooded. And blame it down, it's thicker. So it's working, but then the practicalities.
In other words, scaling it up on this continental size area.
Do we want to scale it up right away, or do we want to think of these technologies as regional interventions so that a community that really would like to have the ice around the area thickened to enable them to carry on their traditional way of life? In my view, that's where we should start. And I don't think the Wright brothers were looking at international aviation. And there are so many examples in history where, you know, we just started with something which, oh, that might take off. Oh, I didn't mean that.
I know. And, of course, there is the equal opportunity of the south, where you used to live, southern part of Australia, and then down into Antarctica, this huge continent.
Antarctica. Just recently there have been some papers, some studies out with really very worrying prognoses for the state of the Antarctic. And it's a different problem there. The sea ice, there is sea ice in the Antarctic, but there are issues with rapid melting of glaciers, the degradation of glaciers.
The southern current is huge, isn't it? It's warming.
The southern current is changing its nature, and you've got to kind of think that warm water, you'd like to think, sits on the top of cold water. You notice that when you swim in the Murray River or something and your feet are cold and your upper body's warm. But salt water is more dense than fresh water. So then the question, does warm, salty water sit on top of cold, fresh water? And that's a delicate balance. And unfortunately, that balance has been disrupted. The toes of the glaciers are now getting warm, and warm water is getting underneath these glaciers. What can we do about it? Well, that's the research that we're looking at here. I'd like to think we could, at the very least, understand what's going on and then perhaps come up with interventions.
Anyone else doing it on that scale apart from Cambridge?
Yeah, so there's a group based in the University of Lapland, who we work closely with, on seabed curtains, which is about the idea that could you anchor a curtain on the seafloor near where the toes of these glaciers are, and the curtain will be held up by, imagine a row of ping pong balls or something, holding the curtain up so that the warm, salty water which is threatening the toes of the glaciers gets disrupted, the flow gets disrupted. It's a totally wacky idea, but we had a conference here in Cambridge at the end of June called Arctic Repair. And all these various people, there must have been 200 people here, really positive feeling that, you know what, not many of these ideas are going to work, but some of them might. Reminds me of Apollo 13, you know, when they sat around the table and said, look, we're not losing these men. And they came up with crazy ideas.
Houston, we have a problem. And of course, the message got through and calculations were done as Apollo 13 was hurtling towards the Earth to crash, but they solved the problems in time.
They solved the problems in time. I mean, the wacky thing is that the explosion on Apollo 13 happened as they were heading towards the moon, and they were only maybe a quarter of the way towards the moon. And the obvious kind of thing is, oh, turn around and come back. But in terms of the energy required to do that, no, they couldn't do that. They had to go all the way out to the moon, slingshot around the moon, and come back. But there wasn't enough battery power to last that long. There wasn't enough oxygen. There wasn't enough carbon dioxide removal facilities. There was no way they should have survived. But they did. So I look at these geoengineering techniques, and I look at our conference, Arctic Repair, and things like the seabed curtains. And I'll tell you what, there was a fascinating group there, a company called, I think, Planetary Sunshades. And they were talking about putting reflectors at the L1 point, out at this point between the Earth and the Sun, where the gravity of the Earth and the gravity of the Sun balance.
And you could linger.
And you can linger, and you could essentially keep this umbrella over the Earth just to reduce the intensity of the Sun by 1% or something, which is what we need. And I always thought this was completely wacky and no way, until you meet these people And you realize that they've been working with Elon Musk and SpaceX for quite a long time. And it's all basically predicated on, if we do start sending spacecraft to Mars, then the idea of dropping off sunshades along the way is like, just, well, why not? And when you start talking to these people, you get quite excited and scared in equal measure.
Excellent. Now let's go and talk to your students.
Our Centre for Climate Repair in Cambridge has been focused quite a lot on this thing, marine cloud brightening. And that basically says there are clouds out there over the sea which do a good job at reflecting sunlight and keeping the sea cool. But the clouds eventually sort of disappear and you're left with clear blue sky. Is there a way of making the clouds linger longer and making them whiter? And it turns out that you can. You spray seawater. The seawater droplets evaporate to produce salt crystals. The salt crystals make their way up into the clouds. And if you can make the salt crystals particularly tiny, sort of 50 nanometers, 100 nanometers, they nucleate tiny droplets in the clouds. And because the volume of a cloud droplet goes as the cube of its diameter, if you've got smaller cloud droplets for the same amount of moisture in a cloud, say half the size droplets, you've got eight times the number of droplets. And this is amazing. You can make clouds a lot more reflective by judiciously putting tiny particles up.
Hugh Hunt, thank you very much.
Been great fun.
Australian engineer Hugh Hunt, originally from Melbourne, is at Trinity College in Cambridge, and he's Deputy Director of the Centre for Climate Repair. And last week's copy of the New Scientist magazine has a cover story of which experts in relevant fields have some doubts about that geoengineering. But will we have a choice?